And you are listening to Against the Grain on KPFA 94.1 FM and KPFA.org. My name is C.S. Song. We have a website, againstthegrain.org. If you look at that website, you'll get links to all kinds of neat resources, including the Jumpstart Ford campaign and some other sites relevant to what we're talking today, alternative fuel vehicles and the controversy over Ford Motor Company's statements versus actions with respect to electric vehicles. Joining me in studio is Russell Long. He's founder and director of Blue Water Network. He's an activist and development ecologist specializing in environmental and public health issues. Michael Brune also joins us. He directs the Rainforest Action Network. He was formerly the campaigns director of that organization, directing strategy for campaigns against timber depletion aimed at Home Depot. You might have heard about the good result in that campaign earlier this year, as well as campaigns against the environmental impact of Citigroup and the rest of the financial service industry. Michael, you were in Ecuador this past March, and you were with an indigenous community opposing oil exploration on their land. Tell us about their situation and what that has to do with oil.
Sure. I went down to the jungles in Ecuador, the Ecuadorian Amazon, back in March with some leaders from Amazon Watch and the Pachamama Alliance. And we were down there to meet with leaders in the Quechua community, which is a community near a village called Sarayaku. And this community they're still living in a thriving, intact, beautiful, lush rainforest area, but they are resisting oil development, which is being led not solely but primarily by Burlington Oil out of Houston, Texas. And the more you do this work, the more you find that these examples are sadly not isolated ones. You know, we can talk about the Uwa in Colombia, who have been resisting oil development for more than a decade. The Warani, also in Ecuador, the Ogoni in Nigeria. We find that there are sadly dozens, even hundreds of examples of indigenous communities who are resisting industrial exploitation and oil development. From a larger perspective, what we're also finding is that one of the primary threats to rainforest health and to biodiversity and indigenous people, and in fact to all life on Earth, is the threat of climate change. So as an organization with a mandate to preserve rainforests and to to work with indigenous communities to protect those areas, we find that climate change is an issue that we can't ignore. And we have, in fact, rededicated ourselves to this issue, and we'll work until we're done to break our addiction to oil.
Can you maybe give us a little bit of a story and put a human face on, you know, exactly what oil exploration is doing, say, to somebody in this community in Ecuador or elsewhere that perhaps you visited or a staffer has visited? Because the suggestion really seems to be that oil exploration, oil exploitation is a human rights issue.
Yeah, it most certainly is. It's a basic human issue. So picture yourself. You're in a little four-seater plane, a couple hundred feet above the canopy, flying into this tiny village, lush green rainforest, like a carpet of rainforest. You can see all the way to the horizon in every direction. You land down on a dirt runway, and you're greeted by the entire village because they're there because they know that you're coming from the country that's the home of this corporation that's coming into their homes. And so you sit down and you meet, and we met for several days. And you get to know the entire community. You get to know the women who are teaching in the schools and the people who maintain the runways and the people who are actually in charge of scouting and sighting to resist this oil company when they come in, led by the military. And we met for, as I said, several days. And I'll never forget this one woman who was one of the elected leaders who said to me, she said, you know, you have to understand what it's like to live here. Our life is so rich. We swim and we drink and we bathe in these waters. And we have for hundreds, thousands of years. We have always considered ourselves free, but now we realize that we're not. And indeed, we will never be free as long as we continue to, as long as your country and other countries continue to drink water or drink oil like they drink water. Until we get the specter of oil development and oil exploitation out of our lives, we'll never emerge from the shadow of the oil industry. And so what we find is that this is just one heartbreaking example of a global problem.
Public sentiment seems to have changed, maybe in some enlightened parts of the country, toward oil companies, the oil industry. This show is partly about the auto industry, and there doesn't seem to be the same kind of public sentiment against the auto industry, the big car makers. People still want to buy their cars and buy their SUVs. So what's the connection between the auto industry, make concrete the connection between the auto industry and what oil companies are doing around the world?
Okay. Well, and Russell, feel free to jump in. It's very simple. You know, cars consume more than 40% of the oil used in the United States. Transportation accounts for 70%. So there is no way that we can break our oil addiction until we build clean cars, pure and simple. There's also a lot of hope here, and hopefully we can talk about this a little bit more, because as Russell was talking about, we don't need to invent our way out of this problem. There are technological solutions that are available today that, if they were put in all vehicles, could at first dramatically increase our fuel efficiency and dramatically decrease our use of oil and certainly our imports of oil. And then there are other technologies on the horizon that could completely eliminate the need for oil in any vehicle that transports us around.
Okay, Russell Long, so what are the currently available technologies that could be put into vehicles right now that could then be offered to the public at an affordable price and really change the air and the climate change situation in a big way right now?
Well, there's several things that are very obvious. One is to move in the direction of hybrid-powered vehicles, which have variable valve timing, which have an automatic shutoff so that the vehicle doesn't idle very long. Obviously, bigger battery packs help. In fact, some of the initial technology around electric vehicles in California is now being used in hybrids. So that was, regardless of the fact they're not building any electrics anymore, we are using those technologies very effectively. We can also reduce the nitrous oxide emissions from catalytic converters by changing that technology. It doesn't really cost anything to do that, but nitrous oxides cause 300 times more greenhouse gas emissions by unit of volume than CO2. We can change the refrigerants in the air conditioning systems from CFCs or HCFCs to more benign products. So there's a lot that can be done at a very little cost, probably in the order of $500 to $1,500 or so per manufacturer per unit. And we're going to get it back at the pump. See, that's the positive here, is that consumers will pay a little more initially, but all of it really comes back and then some. So ultimately, people will have savings over a period of about 5 years.
Well, the demand for, say, hybrid cars is just exploding, right? There are huge waiting lists for these Toyota Priuses. And people seem to be understanding with rising gas prices that this is unsustainable. So then why aren't car companies stepping in, providing more of these kinds of vehicles so that the people who can afford them, and, you know, I guess there is an income equity issue here, but so that more people can afford them, can obtain them?
Well, they are, but it's really the Japanese who are leading the way on this, and Toyota and Honda will probably have their entire line of vehicles be hybrids by the end of the decade. That's our prediction. Toyota certainly is headed in that direction right now, and Honda is going to follow suit. But the other issue is technology. The American manufacturers are behind the eight ball on this. Instead of investing in engineers to go out there and replicate what the Japanese are doing, they're investing in lawyers, they're investing in lobbyists, they're fighting the environmental community at every turn in the halls of Congress and state houses across the country. So that's their mistake. And this is going to hurt them financially over the long term if they don't turn around and try a different strategy in the future. But, you know, they also have another problem, which is that healthcare costs are costing them about $1,500 more per vehicle than Japanese vehicles.
Say healthcare costs?
Healthcare costs for their workers. So they're lobbying Congress, Ford is in particular, to get a national healthcare program because they know that'll help them in terms of reducing costs. So that does create a little bit of a problem for them. And we don't have the answer to that, but they have certainly shot themselves in the foot repeatedly by not going ahead and trying to match the Japanese in technology.
Michael Bruin, what can you add to what Russell was saying about sort of the political might of the auto industry and the pressure it can apply on legislators? And also, why isn't there, say, more political will, maybe not on the federal government level, but on the local level, the state level, to maybe rebuff the auto industry and to do something that's saner and more sustainable?
Well, the political power of the automobile industry is quite clear and quite strong, and the lack of progressive instincts in the auto industry is also quite clear. This is, of course, an industry that lobbied against seatbelts, saying that it would drive Detroit into bankruptcy. So it's, you know, it's a little bit akin to tobacco company executives saying that nicotine doesn't cause cancer. It's an industry that's in deep denial. We are seeing lots of local and municipal legislation being passed that will increase the use of fuel-efficient vehicles. And certainly that's being done state by state across the country and in lots of municipalities. But what we're seeing is that there aren't that many choices out there. There certainly is the Toyota Prius and there's the Honda Insight. There's a couple vehicles that have hybrid options. And those are good, but as you mentioned, there's a six-month waiting list for many of those. What we need to do is we need to elevate this from being a niche issue, an issue of a couple thousand vehicles, to a mainstream issue. We don't think that human rights or environmental values should be something that's treated as a minority concern. What we're seeing is that companies like Ford and GM are looking at hybrid vehicles or alternative vehicles much in the same way that Safeway looks at organic food, something to put on at the end of one aisle for those customers who care about these issues. What they don't understand is that most Americans care about these issues. Most people might need to drive a car. They certainly want to drive a car that's clean, and they want a car that's safe and clean and doesn't destroy the environment.
Could it be said, Russell, that the Japanese car companies, being confronted with this heavy demand for, say, the Prius, are moving away from this idea that these fuel-efficient cars are just a niche kind of situation and they want to mainstream them and make more of them?
Well, I think it's very clear that consumer demand for them is so high, especially for the Toyota Prius, which is the very first dedicated hybrid vehicle, that they're going to have to move in that direction or risk falling way, way behind in financial terms and losing their share of the market. So I think Ford recognizes that it has to go in that direction, and the Escape hybrid that's coming out right now is a step in the right direction, though unfortunately there haven't been any announcements about that technology going into any of their other vehicles in the future, something we'd really like to see from them. But, you know, the future seems pretty clear that we can have a tremendous impact by reducing oil demand in this country if every single vehicle out there is what's called a heavy hybrid, meaning a hybrid with all the advanced componentry and technology. I mean, right now, the U.S. passenger vehicle fleet is using about 7 or 8 million barrels of oil every single day. That's almost 10% of world's demand. So if we can decrease that by 50%, that means we're going to reduce world demand by 5% right off the bat. So that's a huge number, and we can do it. We have the technology. We have the know-how. Nothing has to be invented. Consumers will save money over the long term. There's no reason not to do it.
When I think of electric cars, I think of no-emissions vehicles, and then I think of, well, the electricity has to be generated, right, to power these cars somewhere, and then for it to be the most sustainable way of doing that, then you need kind of solar or wind power, maybe generating the electricity to run these cars. Is the capacity or the ability of this country to produce electricity, say, through solar and wind power, enough such that you could have a truly sustainable, you know, from energy production to the use in the cars, that it could be fully sustainable?
Yeah, you know, the answer is yes. The National Renewable Energy Lab came out with a study, a preliminary one a couple of years ago, showing that you can actually create enough hydrogen just from wind power alone in a couple of states, such as North Dakota, South Dakota, and Nevada, to create enough hydrogen to power the entire vehicle fleet. Or you can do it through solar by taking something like 5% or 3% of the state of Texas's land volume. You could do it as well. And between the two, there's enough power to to power up the entire U.S. electric grid and all the vehicles in the country. So imagine if we rededicated the $200 billion that had gone to the Iraq war and simply gone for renewable technologies that would have powered everything in this country. We'd be in a very different political situation and oil dependency situation than we are today.
That's the voice of Russell Long. He's founder of the Blue Water Network. And also joining us in studio is Michael Brune, executive director of Rainforest Action Network. They are both part of, not the only part of, there are many other groups involved in a campaign called Jumpstart Ford. We have a link to their website on againstthegrain.org, as well as, I believe, links to both Blue Water Network and to Rainforest Action Network. Michael, we've been talking just kind of generically about cars, but, you know, the Think electric car, this was a small car, right? So kind of the issue of size comes up. What about simply mandating that smaller cars be made, that SUVs somehow get limited in their production? Would that help solve the crisis?
Yes, it's true. In this case, size does matter. And it's important to, in addition to having smaller sized vehicles, we would need to have a series of different elements, design elements put in place that would reduce the drag on vehicles and would increase fuel efficiency. This is part of the package that Russell's talking about, in which no new inventions would be required, but a series of innovations or design elements that could be put into place that are already in place in certain vehicles that could increase fuel efficiency from where we are today, which is an average hovering in the low 20s, up to 45 miles per gallon, if you look at the studies done by the Union of Concerned Scientists. And think about that. If we were to simply take the best of what's being offered in the automobile industry today and consolidate it and put the best design into all vehicles and still have great variety and lots of creativity in the vehicles, we could increase our fuel efficiency from the low 20s to the mid 40s. That would save more than 3 million barrels of oil each day. What that would represent is all of the oil that we currently import from the entire Middle East, plus all of the oil that supposedly would come from the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
Wow.
And all of the oil that's coming from the California continental shelf and more. So there's a lot of hope here, and there's a lot of great things that can be done. What's absent is political leadership and political will. And so the coalition that's being built of groups like Global Exchange and other human rights activists, other human health activists who are resisting oil development at its source in the refineries or in endangered ecosystems around the world, student groups, scientists, what we're all trying to do is to wake up the automobile industry and to give them a jump start. It's a great campaign, and we certainly urge people to get involved. Go to jumpstartford.org, or you can visit rainforestaction.org, or Blue Water Network's website as well, bluewaternetwork.org.
To what extent can Ford's decision not to scrap these vehicles, these Think electric cars, they planned to scrap about 400 of these used cars. The Norwegian government and Norwegian company came forward and said, look, we're ready to buy these cars, and we have consumers in Norway that want to buy them. And they were rebuffed for a time, and then Ford reconsidered, although today they didn't seem to confirm definitively that this would happen. But Russell, to what extent was that kind of reversal, apparent reversal, of course, by Ford, a product of the Jumpstart Coalition's efforts, the campaign's efforts, as opposed to perhaps other pressures?
I think it's very hard to say, but Ford is smarting from some of the attacks that we've made upon them as a coalition in the media. And specifically, we had there have been some protests that RAN and Global Exchange have organized and we've been a part of. We've also run a full-page ad in the New York Times twice now, two different ads. And the first one was this spring when we depicted Bill Ford with an extended proboscis. We had a headline that said Bill Ford Jr. or Pinocchio. And we chastised him over breaking his pledge to increase fuel mileage, which he reneged on. And then subsequently we ran another ad on behalf of the environmental community showing that Ford makes the world's worst gas guzzlers. And it shows a graph, and Ford is clearly depicted as falling down to the bottom of the chart. They're at rock bottom compared to all the other manufacturers. And others, I mean, GM, formerly the probably the Darth Vader of the auto industry, is looking a lot better than Ford. And Toyota and Honda, of course, are way above both of them. So, you know, I think Bill Ford is concerned. The consumers are realizing he's not an environmentalist. He's not acting like one anyway. And for him to start walking his talk is something he's going to have to do if any of us are ever going to take him seriously again. But it doesn't appear that he plans on doing that anytime soon unless consumers go out there and pressure him very, very hard. And in fact, Blue Water has been asking consumers not to purchase any Ford vehicles or any of the owned and operated companies such as Volvo, Mazda, Jaguar, Land and Range Rover, which are all owned by Ford as well.
Is that a big part, Michael, of what the Jumpstart Ford campaign wants people to do? And what other demands are you planning to make on Ford?
The pressure on Ford vehicles is certainly a big part of our campaign. Excuse me. We want people to vote with their dollars, essentially. And that does mean that not only Ford vehicles, but for all you residents in Berkeley, all of the Volvo vehicles as well should be off limits. But the campaign is, in fact, a global one, and we will be pressuring Ford at all of their dealerships around the country, every auto show where they come out. The problem that we're combating is that Bill Ford, as you heard, is working to portray himself as an environmentalist, and we need to combat a very polite and a very articulate element of deception coming from the company. They are, if you were to read what Bill Ford says, you would want to nominate him to be the mayor of Berkeley. He certainly sounds like he's one of the most passionate and ardent environmentalists out there. But if you look at what Ford is doing, and some of the things that we've been talking about, you realize that they're putting more money behind their PR than they are into their actual programs. There's a full-page ad on the back cover of Mother Jones, the current Mother Jones, talking about Bill Ford's River Rouge plant and how it has a green grass roof and how it's doing so many good things for the environment. What needs to be revealed, of course, is that that same River Rouge plant is producing 280,000 F-150s, which get a whopping 14 miles per gallon around the country.
The trucks. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
So what we're seeing is we're seeing Ford do one thing and say something that's completely different. And so what our campaign will do is simply hold up a mirror to the company and watch as their sales continue to plummet.
We only have a couple minutes left. Russell, I wanted to ask you about, there's a lot of advertising, maybe there always has been, about sort of the power of vehicles on the road today, right? What they offer in terms of performance, I think, is the word. And I was reading something, maybe from your campaign, about the degree to which technology that could reduce fuel economy, could increase fuel economy, is instead devoted to parts and functions of the car that have to do with torque and power. Is there something to that argument?
Well, it's true because, we've seen that in the past 10 or 15 years, there have been tremendous increases in efficiencies in the engines of these vehicles. But instead of those efficiencies going into higher fuel mileage, what manufacturers are instead doing is, realizing it's a competitive market and they need to have performance edges whenever possible. They put it into horsepower and acceleration and bigger chassis, bigger bodies, larger vehicles, more interior volume and so forth. And so as a result, we're not making any progress on the national fuel economy standards, and we haven't for the past 19 years. I mean, this is a serious, serious problem. When you look at cars, the average fuel economy is 27.5, and it's been cast in stone for two decades now, and we haven't raised above that. SUVs, it's going up to 22.2, which is a very incremental change from a few years ago. But, in reality even, the window stickers are wrong. So if you notice that your new vehicle is supposed to get 27.5, in reality, you're going to get about a third less than that. So you're going to be getting at about 20, 21 miles a gallon on an average of city and highway driving. So that means we're not even getting the 27.5 that Congress believes we are. We're getting far less than that. And we can do so much better. Congress can solve this problem for us in an instant if it had the will to do it and if the president were behind it.
We have to leave it right there. JumpstartFord.org for the Jumpstart Ford campaign. Lots of other links on our website, AgainstTheGrain.org. Russell Long with Blue Water Network. Michael Bruhn with Rainforest Action Network. Thanks to both of you for joining me today.
Thank you, CS.
Thank you.
And this is CS suggesting that the important thing is not to stop questioning. And Sasha and I will talk to you tomorrow about Walmart and the social wage. See you tomorrow.
Against the Grain is produced by C.S. Sung and Sasha Lilly. Please visit our companion website, againstthegrain.org. And to make a comment or suggestion, drop us an email at againstthegrain@kpfa.org or call us at 510-848-6767, extension 209.